You're listening to the Party in My Plants podcast, and fasten up your headphones because this is a genuinely thrilling ride through history, ending with why Black veganism and cruelty-free eating is a way better take on the vegan movement. Welcome to the Party in My Plants podcast, where I make healthy living as fun as a party so you'll, you know, actually want to do it and then actually feel, look, and live your best. I'm your host, Talia Pollack. Now let's get this party started. I am over the moon excited about today's sponsor. Friend, this is my dream sponsor. The, oh my God, is this real life sponsor? The sponsor I've been dreaming about since I was a little girl, winning card-giving holidays with her reliable tearjerkers, ending fights with soul-spilling letters left on people's pillows, and surviving college by avoiding all test-taking classes and taking only essay-writing ones. No, this sponsor is not a pen or a computer or those yellow Papermate Sharp Writer number 2 mechanical pencils that you turn the tip of, which I've used religiously for 2 decades. This sponsor is the thing I've been writing up to my whole life. It's my book. My first freaking real life will live in stores if stores ever open up again, but can live on your shelf right this second book, Party in Your Plants, which has been called in an Amazon review as the best plant-based book ever, as well as a cookbook that's way more than a cookbook, and a plant party heaven. Readers have also said that it's the best healthy living guide for your kitchen that you must purchase pronto. And so I'm here to tell you that you can promptly purchase Party in Your Plants, 100+ plant-based recipes and problem-solving strategies to help you eat healthier without hating your life, anywhere books are safely and sanitarily sold. Partyinyourplants.com will take you to all the major retailers, or you can just hop your fingers over to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, or Walmart to buy yourself and your best friend and their best friend a copy today. That's partyinyourplants.com to grab a copy or 19 of my book that Amazon readers say you must add to your cookbook stack ASAP because it gets all the thumbs ups. Dr. Reverend Christopher Carter's jaw-dropping impressiveness doesn't stop at his credentials, passion, and expertise. I felt like I was in school during this interview because Christopher's views, research, background, and way of explaining Black veganism and cruelty-free eating was better than any binge-worthy documentaries I've come across during this pandemic season. His passion for social justice, racial equality, food, animals, and the environment made this such an incredibly energy-packed plant party. I loved his points about how vegan lifestyles that are self-centered don't really bring the impact that they could. He schooled me to the apple core. In our chat that I truly never wanted to end, Christopher explains how we can fill our grocery bags and load up our dinner plates in a way that doesn't cause harm and is in solidarity with Black Indigenous people of color and their history. I mean, if you ever needed a powerful why to change your dietary lifestyle habits, this is it. Reverend Dr. Christopher Carter, thank you so much for coming on the Party in My Plants podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to it.
I am really looking forward to it. I'm looking at you right now. You're sideways on my screen, which is hilarious. So I'm watching you in San Diego sideways in the beautiful weather. So this is a delight.
Yeah, well, you know, I was trying to mix it up a little bit, you know, give you a different kind of view, toss you a curveball, see how you handled it, but you seem to be doing well so far, so we'll see how it goes.
Well, it's great, because this chat is going to be about different kinds of views. Wow, that was perfect segue. So let's rock it. So you are a reverend and a doctor of theology. Theology, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, theology.
Okay, nailed it. First step in, which is phenomenal. Your work is about racial injustice, particularly the environmental injustices experienced by Black, Indigenous, and people of color. So I'm really wondering, this is so specific, you're so passionate. Why is researching and speaking and writing and educating your life's mission?
I think that, you know, initially, you know, it wasn't. You know, when I was younger, so I guess shout out to anybody who's like in their late teens, early 20s that don't know what the hell they're doing. Like, just kind of hold on. Eventually you might figure it out. I was just very, you know, focused on just the day-to-day grind like everybody else. I've always been passionate about environmental stuff in nature because I kind of, my grandparents and my family's from the South. They're from the rural areas of Mississippi and Louisiana, respectively. And I just love being outside. I love nature. I love connecting with it. My grandpa had a big, what do you call it, a garden, but I think what the hipsters now will call a homestead, where, like, you know, he grew a lot of food and stuff like that back there. And so that was just kind of my regular upbringing, right?
Is that where you grew up also?
Yeah, no, I would go, so I grew up in this city of called Battle Creek, Michigan. It was only like, okay. I mean, it's not like a real city. It's like 50,000 people. So it's kind of like, in Michigan, it's a city. But like when I got to California, I realized that's like a village. So not like a real city.
That's really funny. Okay, so you're in the kind of city life and you're visiting your grandparents on the home, growing their stuff.
Exactly. So we would go there for the summer, right? We would go there for the summer and we would just play outside and, like, you know, like climb trees and like see all these animals. And it was just like a totally different experience. And I think just that kind of gave me this appreciation and deep connection just for the environment, for people having access to it and being able to enjoy it. And then when I got to graduate school, it was really what it was. I got my bachelor's degree in business administration. I mean, just like a regular degree.
Wow.
And I went to graduate school to study. I got a full ride scholarship and realized that my connection and my appreciation for the environment, that my experience was unique, that a lot of people of color, a lot of Black people who grew up in the cities and in more urban areas don't have access to these kinds of spaces. They don't get a chance to really enjoy nature like I did. And more specifically, a lot of the harms and detriments, the ways in which we think about and mistreat the environment, operate out of the same kind of similar thinking that people use to justify the way in which they marginalize people of color.
Wait, where did this come from? You were in business school and then you, like, what? I'm sorry. You just one day woke up and realized this enormous topics that you wanted to just unpack. You just, like, woke up one day, you know, like, how did you get to that realization?
Yeah, it wasn't so much a waking up one day as much as I would say it was a slow process of reading and seeing what was in front of me, you know? And mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, in some ways, waking up is an appropriate term of, in the sense of, you know, like when you're first waking up and you're kind of still groggy and drowsy and still trying to make sense of the world. I kind of felt like that the more I kept reading and learning and listening about people's experience in nature and the lack of experience that people had in nature and finding about environmental injustices, right? Like, so I, again, grew up in a very kind of semi-urban space with a decent amount of toxic pollution because there are a lot of factories in West Michigan. I didn't know anything about that, obviously, growing up in, you know, just in high school. But I had all these friends that had, like, asthma and have all these people that end up getting cancer. And all these people that end up having these other diseases. And so when I got to school and I'm in business school, I'm reading about this. I'm just like, man, there seems to be some kind of connection between people who live near these places and the people who have these kinds of problems. And so it was just out of my curiosity, I think more than anything else, that I kept researching and reading and being able to put things together helped me be able to see that this connection was done intentionally, that a lot of these places, so where I'm from, Battle Creek, Michigan, is where Kellogg's and Post are. So that's where your cereal comes from. So a lot of these factories, that's a big deal to me. So I say that because I'm like,
No, it's just so funny, like, where your cereal comes from. Like, I think of, like, avocados, you know, like, I've been to an avocado farm in, like, Costa Rica. There's my avocados. Like, it's just like, that's where your cereal's grown, boys and girls.
Not really.
We have cereal trees in my backyard.
That was like Fruit Loops there, but we actually don't technically. It kind of does, actually.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what I'm saying. That's not good.
That's hilarious.
It shouldn't smell like fruit. That's not good.
No.
That's not good. So So yeah, it really was a process of just making connections. It's really, you know, so it was kind of like a gradual recognition of what was going on around me. And so these were spaces that I saw that people were really hurting, and I didn't see enough activism around it. I didn't see enough, you know, for me, a theological argument against it. And so I wanted to be a part of that solution. I wanted to help people become aware of what was going on and help create not only dialogues, but tools and resources, people begin to make changes. And so, yeah, it was like, it was just, it's a long, you know, slow process of just becoming aware of what really fundamentally matters to me and allowing myself to be the person that I feel like I've been called to be.
It's really cool. You really took a unique upbringing, this city life where, you know, quote unquote, city life with a lot of nature that I guess your friends and everyone you were in school with didn't also experience. And you realized that that was unique and that you, in a way, had a gift of being able to go out into the nature. And so basically what you're saying is that most, you know, Black or Indigenous people of color are lacking the ability to experience nature and to get the healing benefits of nature and are just stuck in cities with Fruit Loops in the air, for example? Is that where, that's where the awakening came? Because your passion started sounding with nature.
Yeah, my passion definitely started with the environment and it moved towards food. But you're right. And to be fair, there are a lot of people of color, Black, Indigenous people of color who live in the country, right? Who live and able to experience the benefits of being outside in the environment. But so many of Black people especially live in urban spaces for lots of reasons that really go back to, you know, segregation and then white flight. And eventually, you know, there's a great migration of people like my grandfather, who was in Mississippi, who was a farmer, who realized he couldn't do that work down there and like survive, that they wouldn't let him. And so that he came to Michigan to get a factory job. And so there's this huge thing called the Great Migration that a lot of people came to these more urbanish places. And so, yeah, it started out as that and it grew into taking seriously the ways in which food injustice and environmental injustice kind of intersect.
Yeah, because when we were on an NPR podcast a few weeks ago together, you just like, you skimmed the surface in the short time we had together on what it means to be Black and vegan and how most people like myself never have thought of those two things connecting. So I would love for you to please connect those things for me and others listening who might not have ever thought about it.
Yeah, so in many ways, it goes back to kind of tying in, or I guess even finishing the story I was sharing earlier. So I'm in graduate school, you know, studying to be a, you know, ordained clergy person. And I start just feeling convicted about the ways in which I see the treatment of non-human animals and the messages that I'm talking about and preaching on Sunday mornings. And I'm talking about freedom, I'm talking about liberation, I'm talking about not being oppressive or not doing no harm. And I see the ways in which I don't feel as though I'm living up to that standard myself in with respect to non-human animals. But I'm still kind of like, I don't know, you know, because a lot of people can make arguments against that. And so ultimately, for me, what really kind of changed it was, I guess, two things. One, my wife, who is now a veterinarian, has always been passionate about animals. And so
she's a vet. Oh my God. What a
Yeah, so she's a veterinarian.
I just got chills. Like, what a perfect surprise. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I saw on Instagram she's a doc, but I wasn't sure, like, doc of what? Oh, what a that's neat. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, so she's an animal doctor. And so she's always been passionate about animals, and she's always treated our companion animals as family. And I didn't grow up with anything like that. And so that kind of, again, was another way for me to make a connection. But deeply, the connection became when I began to read about the ways in which people like my grandfather and my ancestors, the ways in which they were enslaved and the ways in which they were dehumanized and the ways in which they were treated like animals, and how much of that treatment of them during that time is consistent with the ways in which we treat animals that are in factory farms right now. And I saw those, the overlap. It became just so obvious to me just by doing a little bit of research. And I could see that, for me at least, I could no longer participate in the exploitation of another life for my own benefit if that didn't need to happen, right? Like, I don't need to eat animals. I don't need to eat meat in that way. And I knew that. And deeper than that, I can see that the logic, the reasoning, if you look at the things that were written and the arguments that were used to justify the enslavement of Black people and justify the continued Jim Crow and racial oppression of Black people, it is the same arguments that people use about the exploitation of animals. It's, oh, they're not like us. They're a little bit less than. It's for their own. What would they do if they were roaming free? Like, well, you know, it was the same kinds of arguments for Black people, like, we have to protect them from themselves. They don't really know how to live a life by themselves. Like, and this is for their benefit. And so when you see that, I realized that this kind of logic that we're using is fundamentally flawed, that it's harmful, not only to people of color, but it also undermines, I think, a lot of what it means for white people, especially even to understand who they are and how they function. It creates this kind of false hierarchy of thinking yourself better than other people. And so, yeah, I decided at that point to become vegetarian because the idea of becoming vegan, like to go from, I was a straight up carnivore. Like I was like eating, I was Midwestern, just eating meat all the time. So it was a gradual, probably like 3-year transition to veganism. But for me, it was deeply interconnected to my family. It was deeply connected to my grandfather and my ancestors. It wasn't so much for my health. It wasn't so much for, although those things were a part of it. It was primarily because I found this as a way to be in solidarity with other oppressed groups.
Wow. Are you, I don't want to say inventor, but is this your, like, is this a thing that other people know about? Because this sounds like a brilliantly philosophical, passion, like amazing idea, for lack of a better word. Like, did you come up with this? This is really fascinating and amazing.
I didn't come up with it. I will say that it's an interesting question. I think there have been many people who've made this connection. And I think now in our current social, because of social media and the ways in which we're able to connect, those people who probably thought about this for a long time were able to connect with each other. And so what I describe now as Black veganism which is what I just described as veganism. That's much more not only rooted in a philosophical approach, but also rooted in a way in which it's anti-oppression and centered on people as opposed to non-human animals. I would say in the last probably 10 years has gained more and more traction. And there have been a few proponents that are really well known. I would say one, her name is Breeze Harper. She had a book come out maybe in 2010, I think, called Sister Vegan, where she's making these connections. She doesn't use the term Black veganism, but she's making these same kind of connections. I don't know if I would say anybody coined the term necessarily, but if I were to say, my guess would be these two sisters by the name of Af and Sil Co. They have this website called Black Vegans Rock. They have a book out about them that really kind of unpacks their Black veganism philosophy. It's an excellent book that talks about the intersections of race, gender, and class with the animal movement. And so I would say we've been able to collaborate over the last few years in ways in which I don't think would have been possible. But people, and Black people especially, have been making the connection between the abuse of animals and the abuse of Black people forever. I mean, Frederick Douglass wrote about this in the 1800s, right? Like, so this isn't like, it's not new.
Right.
But I think it is a new way to think about veganism, because veganism is often understood as a not only a white way of eating, but also a white woman. No offense, Taya. It's the ways in which, it's often.
No, I was going to, I just wrote down white in big letters. And I was going to say, why do you think that is? Why is veganism associated with like the white woman way of eating?
Some of it, I think, is marketing. To be fair, right? I think some of it is marketing. I want to give credit to people who spend a lot of money to craft an image and to make those whole food commercials and to make those, you know, advertisements that speculate that this healthy way of eating is ideal for a certain group of people, maybe not for others, right? So I think that's a part of it. I think another part of it has to do with, because it's been marketed as quote unquote white, there is resistance to this way of eating by Black people because it feels as though you may be selling out. You feel as though you're not being authentically Black by eating this particular kind of way. And again, all that stuff is just made up.
It's so made up. It's just a way of eating. But no, you're so right. I mean, and this is what infuriates me about the quote unquote wellness industry, that the quote unquote wellness industry took a healthy diet that is not only healthy for our own bodies, but for the environment and the world around us. And it made it cool and trendy and sexy and appealing, you know, like that's what it is. And I'm going to calm it down, but it enrages me. It's one reason why I've been stepping out of the wellness world as much, because it's not trendy. It's a self-care practice and an environmental, global, you know, way to live that improves the lives of every little living being around us. And it's not just cool. And I guess that cool image is like what you're saying, where like it's just the trendy white girls showing other trendy white girls like, eat this way and you'll be cool too. And then everyone's just going around, you know, that's the image. That is the branding. And I totally understand why, if you're a Black woman, you're like, I don't want to eat like that. Like, I don't want to give in and be like that. Like, it's separating it. And it's so infuriating, because it's a way, it's putting food in your body. How is that related to color?
It's not. It's related to culture, like, right? You know?
Yeah,
you
say, like, culture.
It's definitely related to culture. And so, you know, you have, like, I have friends of mine that are Egyptian or North African. And so, like, clearly there's cultural ways, or Jewish especially. Like, so there's, I have friends who are vegan who
eat
a particular. I thought you might be, but I wasn't going to say anything.
So, it's pretty obvious. No, have you seen this thing on the front of my face?
That's not it. It honestly was just some of the things you, so again, I am a religious studies scholar. And so there are some things you said.
I was like, doctor.
Okay, what
if I said? I'm curious.
The last podcast, I have to get my notes. I'll remember in a minute. But you said you said something where I was like, I wonder if she's Jewish.
Oh my God, I'm so curious.
But I will say, so my best colleague friend, his name's Aaron Gross. He has a nonprofit called Farm Forward, which is, I'm on that board, and they're an anti—
Yes, you are. I had a question about that.
Yeah, and so, but, so keep going. So he's Jewish. And so I hang out. So this is going to sound so weird. It's like, this is like the anti-racism thing you don't want people to do. So people listening, don't do what I'm doing. Like, I have a lot of Jewish friends. And so,
well, good. I have a lot of Black friends. So we're even.
So anyway, back to the point we were making. I actually think to what you were saying about how veganism is a way of eating that's been basically marketed to look a certain kind of way. And I think that has done a disservice, I think, to white people, but particularly I would say white women, because it allows them to silo their veganism without actually seeing how it is intersectional, and it can do to think about eating in a way that is that does no harm, right? To think about eating in a way that actually is cruelty free, you have to think about not just the animals and not just yourself. It can't be a selfish way to think about it, right? We have to center the people who not only work in the factories, right, that work in the fields to grow the food, right, the environment that produces it, like, it starts maybe within you, but it must move outward to be inclusive of all those people. And I think that way of thinking, I think it's to me, it's fairly obvious, but it's not marketed that way, right? It's marketed in such a way where it's very much about being self-centered. And so I'm trying to resist that. I'm trying to deconstruct that and help people make these connections and say, hey, if you want to be vegan or you are a vegan, that's great. Let's think about the ways in which your veganism should also influence, you know, what you buy, like where you buy your food, what companies you support, because maybe, you know, they're exploiting labor in other places and things of that nature. Maybe their practices actually harm people of color or harm women in other ways. So let's think about what this logic of eating, what veganism means at its core, and how that actually applies to the rest of our lives.
Amazing. Okay, so this is perfect, because you have a book coming out soon. When is it coming out?
So I'm hoping it's going to come out in the like early spring of next year. So I would say early 2021. It was supposed to come out.
You have to wait that long?
I know. It was supposed to come out earlier, but literally everything with the university press has just slowed down because of the pandemic. And it's like, it's frustrating, because this is like the ideal time for what I wrote. I think the message really resonates.
Yeah.
What do you do
when damn it.
No, I'm like, you can't.
That was so good.
You know, a global pandemic's going to happen and slow everything up. So it kind of is what it is. But yeah, it'll be out early next year.
Okay. Well, it's called The Spirit of Soul Food. And in it, you talk about exactly what you were just saying, I think, practices that anyone committed to an anti-racist or anti-oppressive way of eating should adopt in order to support food workers. And exactly what you were just saying. So, I mean, I'd love to talk about some of those ways because I'd love to make this actionable. So anyone that's listening who is just eating their plants, I don't want to say selfishly, but only because it benefits themselves, which is, as you know, how I started. I was in tremendous pain with my digestion and my whole body suffered as a result. And then my outward life suffered, my confidence. I was depressed. I was just sucked. I was just a shell of a person. It was horrible. And the plants saved me for real. But after, I mean, I've been eating this way now since 2008. So it's been 12 years. So now after a while, it's obviously spread to, like you said, outward from my own benefit. But I'd love to talk about some of these ways that we can make good food choices that also make good human choices. So can you walk me through some of these ways?
Yeah. So in the book, I begin the book by telling a lot of the same stories that we talked about early on in the podcast about my family and the importance of story and how story really, I think, is woven into who we are and how we understand ourselves. And it gives us a little bit of a vision, or can help us craft a vision of who we want to become. And so for me, a lot of the ways I tell stories is through cooking. And so at the end of the book, I have three practices that I kind of practices. So I'm kind of thinking like spiritual practices, contemplative practices, however you want to frame them, but just three kind of general things I think people should be doing to eat in ways that are anti-oppressive. And the first one is actually start cooking your food. Like literally, which
done.
I know exactly, but I mean, I'm sure you know. There's so many people who don't, who really see cooking as a chore, because we, to a certain degree, we've made, you know, especially if you're a woman in America, we have made cooking such a domestic responsibility, specifically towards women. I can see how a woman can hear what I'm saying and just be super reactive and be like, "What do you mean, make it something fun?" You know, I have to, you know, And what I am hoping that I do in the book and what I would advocate now is to just reclaim that space as sacred, like to really go in your kitchen and be like and sit and like remember meals you had, like with your mother or your grandmother or your uncle, whoever was when they're cooking, or the recipes they made, the things that really made you feel like you were home, like the things you eat. They're just like, man, this brings me back. Like savor in those moments and then try to recreate those for your own family, recreate those for yourself in your own particular situation or circumstance. So for me, cooking is storytelling, right? I'm sharing things that my grandparents cooked, that my mother cooked, that my dad cooked, whatever. I'm telling a story about myself, and I'm telling I'm telling my future son stories about who I want him to become and how I want him to think about what he's eating, what he put in his body. So for me, the first practice, super simple, is just start cooking.
So wait, what are some things that you've cooked from your childhood? Like, I mean, you didn't grow up vegan, so are you veganizing things? And B, to that question, is your family vegan as well? Are they on the plant party train?
So I am veganizing lots of things, and my family is not necessarily, they're not on the plant party train. My brothers and sisters, so people that are in my generation, eat much more plants than parents and my grandpa actually always ate a lot of plants.
If he was growing them, I would, exactly. Yeah.
Well, see, and that was that. And actually, I'm glad you brought me back to that. It reminded me. That was the thing I was going to say earlier about diets and culture. So my grandpa grew up eating a predominantly vegetarian diet because that's what he had access to. That's what we could afford, because it's cheaper when you grow your
plants
own vegetables.
Plants are so cheap. Or just in general, they're cheap. So much cheaper than meat.
Exactly. And so that's what he ate. And so in many ways, a lot of the things I'm recreating are things that they made or things I grew up eating that didn't have a ton of meat anyway. And I'm allergic to fish. I've been allergic to fish my whole life. And so I haven't been able to eat things like gumbo and jambalaya and things like that typically have fish in it. So I think that probably helped to a certain degree to give up some stuff, because I was already like, it already is a health issue for me as a child.
I've never heard of anyone allergic to fish, like all fish.
Yeah. So it started out with just shellfish, but then it just became like all fish when I was a teenager.
Wow.
Like, yeah. I don't know.
That's fascinating.
It's
That's
weird.
Really interesting. Yeah.
Especially if your family from part of your family is from Hammond, Louisiana, and they put like, you know, again, the things I said. I mean, if you're eating, you know, crawfish salad, I mean, there's fish in everything. So I had to have separate little things made for me as a child. And so because I think I have that kind of sensitivity, I've always been mindful of when I cook to try and make things taste as similar as they can. And so I'll make any kind of rice dish that has any kind of sausage. I have numerous sausage like supplements or replacements I can use. Shout out to Field Roast. Like Field Roast to me is like
shout out.
I'm like, I mean, it's just great. I mean, so keep up the good work. And so I would say the thing that I probably make the best that when I bring back home, people always ask me to make are probably going to be my red beans and rice, which again isn't mine. It's just a recipe I found online that I was able to kind of tinker with and kind of make it a little bit my own, but tastes really good. And risotto, which is totally nothing that I ever ate growing up.
Yeah, it doesn't really sound like part of your culture.
No, not really. It's just delicious. And so when I'm home, people are like, oh, can you make that risotto? But again, I use vegan cheese. I use my own cashew cream that I'll make. But I would say probably the red beans and rice, the risotto, the jambalaya, and the greens. I forgot to talk about collard greens. Those are probably the main things that people ask me to make when I go back home. They're totally veganized and nothing like a growing up. Because some other stuff we ate, you know, like cornbread, like that's easy to make vegan, right? I mean, there's certain things we ate that just out the egg.
Just use vegan butter. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really not that hard. And because I'm the primary cook in the family, whenever I do go back to Michigan and visit family, I do the cooking and people eat vegan and they don't, you know, I mean, the way I grew up is whoever cooks, you eat what they make, right? It is what it is. And so unless they want to get in the kitchen and cook, which they don't.
That's funny.
they're eating what I'm making. And it tastes good.
That's great.
And they feel good afterwards. And, you know.
Yep. Win. Exactly. That's the thing with plants.
Exactly. So my grandpa, I would say, is definitely the person who's probably eats the most plants now. But
that's great.
For him, you know, he's 86. So he's just at an age. He's just like, he wants to feel good as long as he can.
Which should be everyone at every age, but that's fine.
Exactly. And so that's really what has made him shift his diet. He's like, man, I just feel better when I eat this. I'm like, well.
So have you like educated your family on all this stuff? Are they receptive to it? You know, have they not made the connection? Because if they haven't gone vegan as well, are they like, how do you handle that?
They are educated on it and they do make the connection. I think probably the way I handle it is I understand that for a lot of what I'm able to do, I have the luxury of having a job that gives me some flexibility and some financial security to be able to do some things they can't do. So one thing I didn't mention to you was that I grew up really poor. And so my family is still pretty poor. And so I would say all of them recognize what I do and they are proud of what I do and happy and support what I do. But at the same time, I am in the space of trying to, and this kind of connects to the second point I was going to bring up earlier, is a lot of stuff is about access, right? A lot of stuff is about access to food. And so, for instance, you know, my mom now lives in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It's a tiny rural town. You know, there's only access to certain things in this small village that she's in. Same thing with my aunt.
Yeah, they're not getting field roast.
No, they're not. Whatever. They're not. And so some of this, I think, has a lot to do with access, education, but also just empowerment and getting a consistent message. I think that if I was closer to home, they probably would eat a lot differently because they would hear me talking about it all the time. But I am in California, and so that has been a little bit of a disconnect. But I do feel good that I do think they're eating. I don't think. I absolutely know. They're all eating differently. They're eating better. And I'm okay with just making progress. Like for me, I'm not the kind of vegan that's like, everybody has to become vegan tomorrow or I hate you. I'm like, I know they're doing better. And for me, that's really important. The way I can help them even do better is the second step of the book of my book is about increasing and giving people better access to food, essentially. So I'm talking about, I argue for churches and other community organizations to turn like their land into farmland. And so I think that's one way.
Oh, that's really smart.
I mean, because you have all this land that often is usually just manicured in grass, right? Like
barely manicured. I've run by some that are barely manicured.
And so imagine if you had a organization that was committed to, I mean, literally providing a service for the local community, right?
That's truly brilliant. Are,
like, growing food, and you can employ people within the community to grow the food, to sell the food, it's really about local, sustainable, and hopefully you can even empower people maybe who perhaps work in factories or work in other places that we know is unhealthy for them to be able to leave that and come and do something else. And so I think that's one way in which a lot of communities, particularly I think this is important for Black people, because in Black religious organizations, churches specifically, is so we have, as people, as Black people, we have less land. We own less land now than we did in 1920, because so many of us were farmers and were driven off the land due to the structured racism of a farming policy. So this was like happened to my grandpa. He knew he couldn't own land in Mississippi. He just knew that was a death sentence. And so he came to Michigan. And so because of those structural inequalities, we actually own less property than we have pretty much since our emancipation. And so one way I think we could begin to combat this and begin to empower our communities again is to, again, take the land that we do own, which is mostly tied up in a lot of religious property, and convert it into ways in which that can actually support that local economy. And so for me, I think that's one way to feed people healthy food, to give people access to healthy food. That's not for profit, right? That's literally, because it's a nonprofit organization, you're doing it just to keep it sustainable. And that to me is probably the most exciting idea that I've come up with.
I mean, it's brilliant.
So thank
you. Do it.
Yes.
What can you do? What do you do?
So there are people, I don't know about where you are in New York, but if you live right now from Baltimore, pretty much down to South Carolina, there's an organization called the Black Church Food Security Network that's run by a friend of mine by the name of Heber Brown. And he has had the same idea. So he and I talked a lot about this, and he's connected farmers, mostly Black farmers, with local churches. And so what they'll do is they'll actually grow food and then bring it to these different churches or other community organizations and sell the food at different places. Again, right? So it's right from farmer to consumer. And so you're working with local farmers, you're getting it right to consumers and people in places where there probably isn't good access to that kind of fresh and healthy produce anyway. And so there are people already thinking about this and trying to do that. And so we're trying to expand that, obviously, beyond that little region. But that's kind of like the hub of an idea that I think really can begin to take root.
Pardon the interruption, but this is a sorry, not sorry situation, because my interruption is to tell you about one of my favorite plant products on the planet, Four Sigmatic Mushrooms. I'm already so hooked on their magic mushrooms of many varieties. I love their hot teas that make lion's mane, chaga, reishi, and cordyceps taste great. And I love their lattes like matcha, chai, and golden milk. But I'm here to hopefully get you inspired to try their coffees, since they're so much smarter for your body than non-Four Sigmatic coffees. To their organic coffee, they add lion's mane mushrooms, whose claim to fame is supporting our brain, and they add chaga, which is wonderful for our oh-so-cherished immune system. Because you listen to this podcast, thank you so much for that, by the way, you get to save 15% off any and all Four Sigmatic shroomy stuff you'll want by going to their site, foursigmatic.com, and using code PARTYINMYPLANTS. Or you can just type into your little type box, FOUR, Sigmatic, SIGMATIC.com/PARTYINMYPLANTS for the automatic 15% off. Woohoo! What is something that I could do? I mean, I'm this white Jewish gal in New York. What could I do to, I already eat plants. Should I, you know, you mentioned before making, you know, buying products that are going to support, you know, positive organizations and not be more oppressive. How do I learn what to do? What can I do, or anyone listening?
Yeah. No, I feel like thank you. That's a great question. I think the first thing that I would encourage people to do is to begin to examine a little bit about why they practice veganism and think about the ways in which it connects beyond yourself. So that's first thing. So I think first thing you got to do is kind of get in your head and say, okay, how can I actually decenter myself? Right. And not make make this totally about me, but see how it benefits me, but also can benefit others.
So let's just recap why that is, because mm-hmm. you said it in the beginning, and I just want to make sure I'm fully understanding and everyone is that by, I forgot to mention, I circled non-human animals, which is something I've never heard. Why are you saying not? I literally wrote it down and I'm like, is it non-human animals? And I'm like, I don't understand. Aren't all animals non-human? What am I missing? I'm like, explain that to me.
Well, I will explain it to you. So we actually are animals. And I think that's something that people tend to forget, that human beings are animals, classified scientifically as an animal. And so, fun fact, and this actually I know happened in New York where you are, when COVID struck, the council that accredits veterinarians across the United States sent an email out to all veterinarians saying, if you live in these COVID high impact areas, you may get called upon to come in and replace nurses, because as nurses and doctors get sick, they're going to need people who actually can perform and do medical stuff on humans, right? Because the training that my wife has, basically, it's the same training. Her clients cannot speak to her. But other than that, all the inside stuff, like the, you know, it all operates the same. And so I say non-human animal as a signifier for us to remind ourselves that we too are part of this kind of interconnected way of being. And once you kind of see that, like, oh, okay, I am evolved out of this animal, right? I'm trying to blur the lines of this kind of oppressive hierarchy.
That's
what I'm trying to do, to help us see where we are and how we fit and how our well-being is deeply connected to the well-being of everything around us, right? Like, it's so deeply interconnected. And I think once we see that, we can begin to care more about it and take better care of our environments.
Boom. Wow. Okay. That's amazing. Just a word, just a phrase. Really is so powerful.
Well, thank you. It's
you're good at what you do, Dr. Reverend. Reverend Doctor.
So I did go to school for a long time. And so that helps. And, you know, I've thought a lot about the ways in which vegans can be, how we can sometimes come off as holier than thou. You know, we can come off as, like, again, in a way in which that turns people off. And so I've really consistently tried to not do that and not be that vegan, you know?
Good. Yeah, I don't use the word vegan at all. Never. I'm going to see, my book was classified as vegan and I threw a fit. Like, we got to take vegan off, guys. We can't. I don't associate that word because of what it represents, because of the exclusivity and the... Like, when you think of usually they're, like, angry people, like, mean.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I've gotten lots of mean emails where my response was through my husband wrote it because I couldn't handle it. He wrote, like, if you're so compassionate towards animals, why aren't you compassionate about fellow humans?
Yeah.
Like, why would you talk to a human this way when you're, like, preaching don't eat animals?
Yeah.
Which I guess is exactly-ish what – this whole conversation is about, if I'm understanding correctly, and I want to bring it back to that intersection. So basically, Black veganism is the idea that the way that Black people have been treated is not far, or maybe exactly, or whatever word you would like to use, from how cruelly we treat animals. And so by not eating animals, by being vegan, it's not a metaphor, but it's, what's the right word, that like is also supporting Black people. Is that correct?
Yes. The thing is, I think most of us, if we think about the rhetoric or the things you hear from, whether it be police officers or people who are against kind of social movements that are happening right now, you know, you'll hear the language, you hear people often refer to as being an animal. They're acting like an animal. These people are like animals, and et cetera, et cetera. And so,
I mean, still, even like lock them up, like locking someone up.
Exactly. Like cuffing. An animal.
Yeah.
And so there's this way in which it's so embedded in our consciousness. It comes out in our language. We haven't, sometimes we don't kind of think about it, to stop and think and say, well, what are you really saying when you say something like that?
Even like herd immunity.
Well, herd immunity, right? Actually it's a veterinarian term. So just like it is.
So animal, all right, yeah, exactly. Animal.
No, you're right, you're right, you're right. You got me. So, what happens is you hear a lot of responses from people of color or social justice advocates would be like, hey, I'm a human too. Like, I'm a human too, so don't dehumanize me. And what I have argued in the things I write about in my book is that kind of logic, what you're then doing, if you want to argue that I'm human too, quote unquote, what you're basically saying is it's okay for a human to be classified as such, as a animal or a particular group of people that are allowed to exploit and oppress others. As long as I get to count as human, then it's okay for other people to get exploited, just not me. And so what I'm arguing for and what I talk about is we have to really redefine what we mean when we say human and what it means to even be a human, and to rethink, well, what are the ways in which I can actually be a human being and live in ways that are consistent with my ethics and my values and my morals, and be compassionate and be open and not do no harm and all these other kinds of things. And so to me, it was just the next logical step was until we redefine what it means to be human, I'm not going to participate in this kind of exploitation of animals, because this human animal binary is what's been, it's been maintained as a way to marginalize a subset of either human beings or animals as less than, or as less valuable, or as, you know, not as intelligent or whatever. Over time, women have been in this space, and, you know, people of color have been in this space. So it's not a jump for us to kind of make that connection. It's just something that we have to actually acknowledge and send things, yeah. Okay, I see it. So yeah, so that for me is a big part of the reason why I think it's important for us to not only recognize the importance of language, but to kind of, I think, just center down and come to grips with what it means to even use the word vegan, or what it means to even say plant-based, and then think critically about what we say when we say things like animal and non-human animal, to the point that we made earlier.
Wow. So it's really, you know, spark notes or whatever, one line, it's like a way of eating in solidarity. In a way, it's like a solidarity way of eating.
Yeah. And so I call it, the part of the reason that myself and a few other people call it Black veganism is to honestly distinguish it from the veganism you were talking about earlier. Because you have like the vegans.
Like the asshole veganism versus.
Yeah. I mean, you could call it that, you know, asshole veganism, you know. So in the.
That'll be the title of your next book.
Yeah. In the academic parlance, we'll say ontologically white veganism. And so what that means, that doesn't make any sense to normal people.
I couldn't even say theology, so yeah, I don't know.
It just means a way of eating or it means a traditional way of vegan, of being or thinking about being vegan is just typically self-centered, or not, doesn't think about the community, right? It thinks about the self, and maybe you like animals, you think animals are important and animals have feelings, so therefore you shouldn't kill animals. But it's not extending that logic out beyond that. And so I find that to be wrong. I find that to be harmful, because it doesn't take intersectionality seriously.
So it's saying Black veganism is not saying you are a Black person being a vegan. You're saying it is a way of defining your veganism, that you're eating in solidarity with people of color. And that's the distinction.
Yes. That's a very good way to say it. That's a very good way to say it. So
this we can, like, I'm like I know. In school right now. I'm sweating. I'm taking notes. Okay. So this all stemmed from me asking you, what can little white girl Talia, Jewish girl in Connecticut, I'm not in Connecticut, I'm in New York, I'm on the border, do right now? And you said, first, realize it's not just like think outside of me and just us. What would, and that's how we got here. What would second be? What's another action maybe that someone could do to help? If we're already eating plants, what can we do to just take that even a step further?
I would say look at where you're getting your plants from. So next thing is to consider is supporting local, not only local farmers, but farmers of color. It doesn't have to be Black. I mean, it'd be great if they were Black, but again, I'm really focused on promoting and helping farmers of color And so buying their produce, buying their food, helping them being able to expand their business and their reach is, I think, one really simple and powerful way. Joining a co-op, right? Like actually thinking about doing things that support local economies and local communities, I think is another thing that's really important and that can help. Because generally speaking, those tend to be places that employ lots of people from lots of different backgrounds, right? And so I think those are probably two of the key ways that I think white people especially can be involved. And then the third one, I would say, is really try to do some reading and some research. And this kind of gets back to the first point I made, too, about what Black veganism is and who's learn about the ways in which this thing can be, and can the work that we do is intersectional, and advocate for those issues, right? So yeah. Advocate for the end of factory farming, because most people in factory farms are people of color, and you see what happened with the pandemic and they're disproportionately suffering, right? Most of the people that are on farms that are growing the plants that we eat, right? These are mostly people of color that are underpaid. So advocating for like fair wages, those kinds of things really help people of color. It really actually it helps farm workers, and it helps communities be able to gain a kind of economic stability that has not been afforded to so many people of color in the United States historically.
This is just, I mean, I don't want to say thrilling because that makes it about me, but it's really empowering to know that I can actually do something by making these choices. You know, we're told support your local farmers. We're told, you know, don't just keep buying from the man, you know, all that. But you're telling me really a why behind that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just like veganism. Like we're told like, just be vegan, just eat plants. But like, here's so much of a deeper interconnected why that is just thrilling. That we can make a difference for not just ourselves, not just the planet, not just other animals, but other humans. Wait, non-human animals. No, actual human animals. We can help with where we get our food and what we eat.
Yeah. And wow. I think, and to me, this is the beauty of Black veganism. Or plant-based eating, or however you want to frame it. It can be something that I think can bring us together on so many important social justice issues, right? Because it really does cross a lot of, it's very intersectional in that way. But we just have to kind of name it and own it and think critically about how are we going to allow our passion for plants, our passion for our health, help others, right? How are we going to not just make this, again, about how it helps me, but how can we help communities who have been disadvantaged and disenfranchised as a consequence of
it. Totally. And eating animals, is that harmful for also Black people of color? I mean, are they the ones working in all the, I don't even really know, all the yucky things that go into producing and killing and whatever the animals, but I would imagine if, you know, Black people of color are working in the farms and mass producing all that. Like there, that's so not buying animals will also help them in that way as well.
Yeah. And so part of what I'm arguing, that's a great question, I should say, because I think what I've tried to do in working with and thinking about, okay, if I'm advocating for a vegan diet, how is it going to harm people who have these kinds of jobs in factory farms? Right. And so I'm thinking about my sister lives in North Carolina, and there's a lot of plants in North Carolina, hog plants especially. And people have argued with me. They say, well, what are we going to do with those people if they lose their jobs? Which in reality, that's, I think, not what's going to happen. But let's just say that did happen. I think what we have to do and what we're better off doing is empowering those communities to do the things I was mentioning earlier about church-supported agriculture and actually getting churches to be able to grow food and produce food, especially in those rural areas where they have lots of land, where they can hire people to actually come and pay them a just livable wage, or they can get like health insurance, for instance, and things of that nature. So I would say buying animal products does harm people of color, because not only are those factories located in spaces that produce pollutants on people of color, but the people who work inside the plants that do the slaughter are mostly people of color. And I cannot imagine the psychological toll it takes on someone to have to do that work every day. And again, these are the reasons for me to not eat meat, because I didn't want to feel like I was going to be complicit in making someone suffer like that.
Well, here's another way. So the first thing we talked about, the first aspect was kind of more, not a metaphor, but more of this solidarity idea. But now this other side to Black veganism is the little tangible. It's like, that's awesome. It's like a two double thing, that one choice to not eat meat or eat more plants, however you want to phrase it, is both like a spiritual metaphorical solidarity choice, but also a tangible, implementable, today things are improving choice at two in one.
Very much so. Very much so. And even like, I mean, even things like your chocolate, you know what I'm saying? I mean, there's a huge movement among Black vegans, especially for people to be aware that, you know, are the people that you buy your chocolate from, are they employing like kids, you know, that basically are doing like slave labor? So
I don't know. Why chocolate?
Well, because a lot of chocolate's grown in like South America and Africa and places where people can be exploited because their infrastructure is not as robust as we have in America to prevent child labor. So that's kind of the nicest way I can say it.
Thank you.
One resource I want to point you guys to, or point your listeners to especially, is called the Food Empowerment Project. They're based out in Northern California, and they have a list of vegan approved like products that where they've really tried to craft and hone down a list of people who actually kind of produce their food the right way and pay their employees the right way and do things the right way.
Great.
And so I think a lot of our choices, economic choices we make, can be used again to support and feel like you're making a difference. Definitely.
Great. Okay. So one other thing I'd love to talk about is just this. I'm just really honed in on how horrible it is that veganism has just been promoted as this white woman thing. Or white, now it's like white male thing, you know. There's a lot of like, like Tom Brady is vegan, and you know, he has all those people who are like, woohoo, and all that. Wow, how can we stop this? I mean, how can we make this better? It's just so wrong that it would just, it's a way of eating. It shouldn't be this like bougie white woman way of eating.
So one thing to do, I would say, what you're doing right now is by interviewing me. So I will say that's one step that you're
going
to, but I think that uplifting like people, scholars, activists, vegans of color who are doing this work on your podcast is definitely like a really important step. I think people who have a big platform would do well to empower folks like myself who are practicing veganism for different reasons that connect to solidarity and a kind of dismantling of what I will call the logic or the reasoning behind the creation of the animal, right? To kind of make us really think critically about why these terms have been used to justify exploitation. There's lots of other people like me. And so inviting us on, having people talk about it, to get us thinking about it so I can become more aware of it. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of Carol Adams' book, The Sexual Politics of Meat. Have you heard of that?
No.
You should get that book.
It sounds like not a light read. Not a beach read.
Not a light read. But I do think, based on what I've, my listening to your podcast, I think you would find a lot of resonance with a lot of things that she talks about. She basically talks about the ways in which we conflate the female body with the language of animal. And I think when you read that, it's just that, again, it's the next logical step, right? It's the next logical step. Like, well, how does this apply to others?
Yeah.
And so, again, like having someone like Caroline or things like that, I think are the ways in which we can begin to dismantle this narrative that vegan is about, you know, white women, or it's about these, you know, wealthy men, or about this kind of power. When really it's just about, like you said, it's about feeling good.
Yeah.
It's about helping us feel good internally, empowering communities. It's about being in solidarity with those who are marginalized. It's all these other things. And the bonus is you get to feel good. Right.
Wow.
Like that's how I see it.
It's just this like harmonious way of living that
I think so.
Yeah. Great. Wow. This was great. Okay. So, probably the hardest question of the day. What is your favorite plant?
Oh God. Man, you did ask that.
I I stumped him.
I know. I'm like literally sitting here trying to think. I would say.
Like right now, like, you know.
Like, my favorite plant is probably going to be mustard greens.
Wow.
Because aggressive. I make like, well, because I made like, so for instance, I made greens. I made it last night for a quesadilla, right? Mm. Where like I can like put greens and pinto beans and mash them up, a little chili flakes, some salt, pepper, garlic salt, some really good olive oil, some vegan butter, you know. And like, so I can do a lot with greens. For me, I grew up eating a lot of greens, and so it's probably my favorite. It's tough, man. I was trying to stop between that and sweet potato.
Sweet potato.
Which is one? Sweet potato's so good, you know. But
I know.
I can do so much more, and so for me, it was more like, I guess the way I heard that question was, if you only could eat one vegetable for like a week, what would it be? And I was like trying to figure out.
That's so funny. If you were stranded on a deserted island, one plant. Yeah. That's how I should ask the question for now. That's good. There you go. That's very smart. Okay. Wait, does your, I don't know, kids, at 15 months, are you eating? You're eating food. Your son's eating food, right? What am I talking about? Don't. Should I edit that out?
No, that's it in there. It's funny.
I meant. It was just a joke.
Yeah, exactly. It's totally a joke. Totally a joke. Obviously, my son's eating. Yeah. No,
well, I didn't know if he was just on the breast milk.
No. They get up. Yeah. So he eats regular food. It's okay.
Is he vegan?
He actually is, I would say, like 90% vegan. So he does have yogurt from time to time because his stomach is still forming biomes. He's had some digestion issues, and I didn't really want to give him probiotics because I was, like, my wife and I were nervous that if he gets on that he would kind of need that for a longer period of time. So we had to give him food that had a kind of a more natural microbiotic in there. And so yogurt's been a thing we've been doing.
Cool.
But so for me, again, I say that to say I understand that not everybody's going to be able to practice veganism all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you know me. I just eat more plants than crap. I eat some fish. I eat some dairy. I eat a little bit of egg stuff. I'm just about eating more plants than anything else.
And so for me, that's how it makes, now it makes it accessible, but also it's just more realistic because for a lot of people in the communities I come from, again, it's about access. Like, this isn't the way they could eat. And so until I can change the ways in which we have access to these foods, I can't tell people to eat a certain kind of way, right? And so this is my problem with people who want to argue, eat this way. I'm like, well, then we have to dismantle the structures that have been created that made it such that, you know, when I was working at Compton, when I was a pastor, there was one grocery store for about 100,000 people. In the city where I was going to grad school, was in Claremont, California, there are three grocery stores for a city of about 40,000 people, right? And so that just tells you right there, you know, the racial makeup of Claremont was predominantly white. Racial makeup of Compton was predominantly Black and Latino. And so that's normal. Like, that's the thing people have to see. That's normal. That's actually how things are. So until we address those structures, we have to empower people to make better choices, give them the opportunities to make choices, because people want to feel good. People want to eat right. They want to do things the right way. I believe that. Fundamentally, I believe that about people. But if you don't give them the access, you make things difficult, then people have to do what they need to do to survive.
Right.
And so that's kind of where I land on it. And so a lot of my work is about, again, access, education, giving people the chance to do what I know they would want to do anyway, and education. Again, like I said, for me, it's about teaching and healing. You know, that's who I want to be, you know. That's and so brilliant. I'm trying to figure out different ways I can be that in multiple different platforms and avenues.
Well, you're doing that. You've done that today. But what was your son's first plant food?
Oh, God. He loves avocado. I mean, he can eat avocado all day. Like, I mean, he can eat, like, so my son, I should also say, my son is a giant for, like, most kids. So my son's 15 months old, but he wears, like, two-year-old clothes.
Wow.
Yeah, so even at the,
that's so funny.
Yeah, the doctor was just like, so he had a doctor's appointment yesterday. She was trying to reassure me because he has like a really big head. And like, so she's like, he's in a 98th percentile in height, the 95th percentile in head circumference. And she's like, well, you know, he's very proportional. She's like, it's okay that he's that big. And I'm like, it's okay. It's okay, doc. I know he's.
That's so funny.
She just thought I was going to be like, you know, I don't know. I don't know what she thought. She's trying to make me feel better that I have this son that eats like an adult. So I think on the other podcast, I was talking about how he eats tofu scramble. And so I'll make that. He eats pretty much anything that I'm going to make red beans and rice for dinner tonight. And he'll eat all of that. So, I mean,
that's wonderful. He's a great
eater. And
that's great.
Yeah. So if you decide to have children, pro tip.
It's in the plans, but I need to be more educated, clearly.
Yeah, you probably want to know that they start eating solid foods roughly around 7 months old, just to kind of depends. And I'm sure by then you would have read up a lot on the things they can do and what they can eat.
Thanks. If not, I have you. So exactly, there we go. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, you mentioned a bunch of books, but is there one that really stands out as a book that you'd really recommend for somebody besides your own that's coming out? Is there any book that you were just, you know, radically inspired you or think could be a good further education?
I think a book that I recommend for people who are trying to learn about the intersection of kind of veganism and social justice would be a book by these two sisters. I mentioned them a little bit earlier, Af and Sil Ko, called Afroism. And they're the people behind Black Vegans Rock. So if you go to their website, you'll find the book. And it's an easy read. In a sense, it's only like 100 pages. And again, so I'm a scholar. So for me, I'm like 100 pages. I'm like, I can knock that out like pretty quickly. But it's at the same time, it's one of those things that you read that makes you do a lot of introspection. And those are my favorite kind of books, right? Where you read something and you're like, man, that makes me think critically about myself, you know, about how I understand the world. And, you know, as much as I try to be an advocate for others, I've realized as I've been married for a long time, how much I can often overlook the ways in which gender is at play and things. And I think they really helped me see that. I'm very much, I'm a man who's in a patriarchal society. And I forget sometimes the ways in which the society is tilted towards men as opposed to women. So it's nice to have smart women like yourself and other people to remind me of that.
Oh, that's great. Wow. Wait, I have to ask you this. Okay, so first of all, how quickly can you read 100 pages? And are you just saying, you know, the fact that you're a scholar and you can do it fast, is that like training? Like you're just, I don't know.
I read all the time. Like I read all the time. And so if it's like what I would call like a fairly, like if it's not an academic journal and it's 100 pages, it'd probably be like about 2.5 to 3 hours, like at most.
Just bang it out.
Yeah. But I love to read. I mean, so that's the other thing too. Like I read all the time because I want to be informed and it's my primary form of entertainment too. I don't watch a ton of television. I read weird stuff to my son. So he's going to, Lord only knows what he's going to think about when he gets older. All these, again.
Wait, he can't read yet, right?
No, he cannot read. He cannot read. So, man.
So. You never know. I'm getting my education here. I was just kidding, everybody. That was a joke.
He was joking. I totally verify that was a joke.
Yes, it was a facial expression. Do you have some sort of like contemplative practice or some like, I just feel like you're always thinking and it's amazing. And I feel similar. Literally, I asked my husband almost daily, Jesse, what do you think the meaning of life is? And I was telling my mom this yesterday. She's like, sweetie, you've been doing that since you were 14. I'm like, what? She's like, you came down one day and I was just standing in the kitchen washing dishes and you asked me what the meaning of life is. And I had no memory of that. And so I live up here as well all the time. So I'm just curious, like, what do you do?
Yeah. So at some point you and I want to have a conversation about why you asked that question to your mom. Cause to me, that's like, that's a non-podcast conversation, but I think that's, because that says something about, that makes sense given what you ended up doing right now, actually, that you would be thinking about those things at that age. But for me, there's a particular kind of contemplative practice that I do that kind of finds its roots in Catholic spirituality. I'm not Catholic, but it's called The Compassion Practice. If there's another book I would recommend, I would say it's this book by this guy named Frank Rogers, literally called Practicing Compassion. And it has its, and when you read the book, you'll see it's like it's very interreligious, like it's not a Christian book, but Frank was one of my professors, and finds its roots in this kind of medieval Ignatian contemplative practice. And really what it does is this process of just being grounded, of sensing the sacred. I know I kind of mentioned earlier about cooking, and for me, that's like, that's that moment of sensing and remembering and savoring those moments where we felt like we were the most authentic ourselves, like we are truly us, and remembering those and having practices where you remember those and developing compassion for yourself and kind of allowing the wounds that come up for us just in our everyday life. Having a practice, a contemplative practice, allows us to tend to those wounds and heal them, not dismiss them to say they're not there, but to really try to say, okay, what's the unmet need? And then extending compassion towards others, creating a way and a space to have a relationship with someone, recognizing that they experience the same kinds of sufferings that you do. And then the last part of the practice is called discerning compassionate action. And essentially, it's taking that the ways in which you have built this kind of compassionate presence in the world or in yourself and to others, say, well, how can I bring this out into the world? Like, what are the things I can do that are deeply rooted in this kind of spiritual path of compassion? And so that practice is pretty much guides everything I do. Even the chapters of my book, I mean, I talk about that in the very beginning. I'm like, it follows the path of the compassion practice. It's just really a part of who I am, and it allows me to, because this work is exhausting. It can really like be taxing. And so you need to have something that allows you to come back to yourself. And so I don't know that I'd be able to do it or do it as successfully as I feel like I'm doing it without that practice.
You're doing it mega successfully. And if I were to use a word to describe you, a compassion would be high on that list, because you just reek it. You reek the compassion, and it's awesome. And thank you so much for coming on today. Where can people go to get more of you? I just want you to blow up. I want everyone to hear this message. I want this to be the new bougie veganism. Exactly. All right. Let's phase that out, bump this up. So where can people go?
So my website is just simply drchristophercarter.com. So you go to that, and that has links to all my articles, things that I've written, other podcasts I've been in, blogs I've written. So that's all my stuff. And that'll point you to my Instagram, where I do a little bit more on there. You know, I'm not like, I haven't quite figured out how to manage all that. I think one of the drawbacks of being such a nerdy person is I don't really get social. I think there's a comedian, Eliza, I can't think of her last name, but she has this stand-up called
Schlesinger.
Yeah, her stand-up, Elder Millennial. Like I was like, that is me. Like, I am 40 years old. I'm still like a millennial, kind of.
So, oh, like, my I God, get some that's stuff, so funny.
But then there's other things I'm just like, like Instagram story, I don't know. Like, what does this mean? You know, so I'm still learning all those things. But yeah, my website, I do keep that up to date. And so that has all my stuff on there, and that'll point you in the direction of all the other little things that I'm doing.
Well, that's one thing I can help you with. So you can teach me theology and big thinking and real shit, and I'll teach you the silly shit, and then we're good.
I see that to you. I think this sounds like a fair exchange. Fair exchange.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again for this conversation. It was awesome, just put it lightly.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. And I mean, I know I told you this before, but I'm really grateful for the work that you do. I really enjoy listening to your podcast. And I'm excited for the new direction that you're taking things. I love the idea of blow yourself. It made me laugh.
Oh, you saw that. Oh, I'm so glad.
It made me laugh. And I was like, well, that's a funny way to do it. But it sounded like you as soon as I heard it. I was like, that sounds like something you would say. I think it's really important for people to be strategic and think critically about what they want to do with their life and take ownership. And that's what I hear you saying. So anyway, no, I'm excited for what you're doing. So keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for listening to the Party in My Plants podcast. I don't know what else to say other than thanks to Reverend Dr. Christopher Carter for schooling M to the E. Since recording this chat, I've heard his words, Black veganism and plant-based eating can be something that bring us together on so many important social issues, over and over again in my head. And I am so grateful that he opened up my eyes and your ears to that. For a recap of this episode's highlights, be sure to fly on over to the show notes that are living at partyinmyplants.com/198. And if ever there was an episode that you wanted to just share, you know, with your Instagram followers, your roommate, your dad, please let this one be it. This is so important. It is so, so important. Also important is that you have a great day. So why don't you go do that? And I will catch you next week.